content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
This is Susie Pratt. I'm reading The Middle Ones by Jay Spear. Dear Ellie, the letter probably would have started, or should I say, dearest? I like dearest, so let's pretend it said that. Dearest Ellie, first off, I'm sorry about the mess. You know how strict they are about meds on this damn ship, so this really was my only other choice. I hated to ruin the floor like that, though. You know I did. Next, I just wanted you to know that everything that I've ever told you in your entire life was based on a complete and utter lie. Sorry again. 7 years before I was born, the Earth, how you say, died. Kaput. Adios, sayonara, see you later, alligator. Croaked, like Ames the Bat did a couple months ago down in the animal ward. That's how my dad used to say things. How you say, and then a long list of the exact words that you would actually use to say it. He was originally from a country called France when Earth was still alive. I think it made him feel good to pretend like he was still an outsider here, a piece of the life that he had had before it all went down. That's one of the few things that I remember about him, because he died when I was 5. 1 minute he was fine, and the next, kaput. Just like Earth, except a lot less all-encompassing. How are you doing, Ellie? My therapist says. She was an ear and nose doctor on Earth, not a therapist. Here she does both. Fine, I say. Truthfully, she and this place make me itch. I want to leave the moment I sit down every week. She frowns. Less than a minute, and she's already unhappy with me. That might be a record. Are you sleeping? I sleep. Last time we spoke about some, she looks down at her tablet, highly irrational night terrors. Last time I was so desperate to leave that I started talking. Just a few bad dreams, I say. Her eyebrows turn down at me. They're so thin, like little pieces of string stuck to her face. I wonder how long ago she learned that term, highly irrational night terrors, and how long she's wanted to use it in conversation. I want to congratulate her on her therapistiness. There's nothing to be afraid of up here, she says. I'm not afraid, I say. I'm frustrated with this spaceship, with these people, with the mundane accumulation of everything that I call life, but she'd never understand that. To her, I should just be one thing, grateful. The Earth is alive, the letter would have said. We all just tell you different so that you can bear the cross we've given you. It's an effort to be sensitive to your feelings or controlling of them. I haven't decided which one yet. The Earth is not dead. Of course, it might as well be to you. You will live out the rest of your life on this ship. That part was always true. You know, your mother, says the therapist. There it is. I was waiting for the conversation to take this turn. It always does. Your mother is a damaged, disloyal, useless, grade-A crazy. Your mother lives her life worrying about what she can't control, Ellie. And she's a very sick person because of that, she says. We'd hate for you to turn out like her. I just nod my head yes. I'd rather not talk about my mother. When the asteroid hit, both of my parents were scientists at the World Labs back on Earth. They were smart, young, healthy, pretty much everything that a savior of humanity needed to be, which is, of course, why they were chosen to board the ship. The fact that they had a high genetic probability of giving birth to a girl didn't hurt either. I have no idea if they even wanted to have a baby. The promise to have me was a job requirement. Since my dad died, my mom spends most of her days on the couch with a hot towel lying across her eyes. She says she gets headaches, but I think she just doesn't want to be bothered by anyone. I understand why she shuts herself off, though. I feel frustrated and trapped on this ship, and I've never even lived on a whole entire planet before. I won't judge her, even if everybody else wants me to. I'd never let her know how much I need her to snap out of it. Have you heard the story of Rumpelstiltskin? The letter would have asked. I doubt you have. It was a children's fairy tale on Earth, but no one would have thought to bring that story up here, and I can't remember ever telling you. It's about a young woman who makes a terrible mistake and promises her child's life to an evil elf in exchange for gold. She isn't heartless, though. Please don't think that. She just isn't prepared to think of anyone's happiness but her own. It's not until years later, when the child is born, that she realizes what she has done, and then it's almost too late. Luckily, she finds a way to win the baby's life back, and all is well in the end. But that's why it's a fairy tale, isn't it? In fairy tales, people have cute little opportunities like that to redeem themselves. Getting excited for university, says the Erin Nosopist. I decide to answer truthfully. It usually speeds up the process. I'm excited to go to another part of the ship every day, I say. Her string eyebrows confirm that was the wrong answer. Aren't you excited to study space botany? That's a very exciting profession. Her voice goes up an octave on the word very, like she's trying to convince a baby to use the toilet. I'm excited to study space botany in a different part of the ship every day, I answer. I know I could make this easier on myself, but she's just so, how you say, annoying, smug, arrogant, able to make me feel the size of an insect. The rooms at university look just the same as the rest, Elliot, she says firmly. Yes, I say, but I get to walk by the gym instead of the dining hall to get there. I allow my voice to go up like hers. I feel like I'm being charmingly satirical, but her face tells me that I've gone too far. Ellie, she says sternly, you are alive. That is a quality that most of the human race has been forced to forfeit. You should try showing your respect for the sacrifice instead of mocking it. Gratitude, loyalty, and commitment to your duty are the best way to do this. She hit the nail on the head there. I am alive. In fact, my whole purpose on the ship is to be alive. I am the product of an entire world's hero complex, one of humanity's little repopulation beans. Just plant me, water me, throw me in a suffocating metal box, and let me thrive. You don't understand, Elliot, she adjusts her body in her chair, that you'll be 93 by the time the ship lands. Chances are that you won't even be alive to see the new planet. I'm very healthy, I say. I've never missed a vitamin. Well, maybe it would be a good idea if we focused on the life and duty that we have here instead of fantasizing about things we probably won't get to experience. You're graduating soon, moving on to your advanced studies, and then, we hope, children. Her face lights up at the word children. That's all I am to her, a seat saver for the real knights of humanity, the ones who actually get to land. My body is a vessel, just like this ship. Earth wasn't perfect by any means, the letter would have said. There was disease, pollution, war. People could be cruel. But it had a pulse, Ellie. It was alive, and it had a pulse. I want you to remember that, because I never could. Having children was not legal anymore, at least not for people like us. The overpopulation problem had produced birth restrictions for all but the wealthiest and the most powerful. Go on the mission, they said. Have your baby, they said. Help conquer the frontiers of space. Be a hero for your species. It was a chance to not only have you, but also make sure that you were safe and healthy and meaningful. Who could blame us for our choice? Except you, of course. When the opportunity to use any more therapist terms run dry, I am finally released. I make my way back to our living quarters. When the opportunity to use any more therapist terms runs dry, I am finally released. I make my way back to our living quarters, contemplating how long someone could live outside of the airlock. It'd probably be only a few seconds, but I'd never have to sit through one of those sessions again. I decide it might be better to just throw the therapist out instead. The truth is that it isn't her fault that she's been damaged into boringness. After all, I never lost my entire planet. Earth was never mine to lose. When I walk into our apartment, I don't even notice that she isn't on the couch. It's the smell that hits me first, like metal. A second later, I see the blood. That's when someone immediately ushers me outside. We lie to you because we don't have the guts to tell you what you really are, Ellie. You're a time waster before the real mission can start. In many years, your children will be the first to colonize the second home of the human race. But you will be dead. you're the unfortunate casualty of the incredible persistence of mankind. It's a very long trip, after all, and someone needed to be the middleman. You were our gold, Elliot. We were just too narrow-minded to realize that you'd be the cost, too. Your happiness for ours. That was the deal. Not so nice of a trick in the end, huh? 18 years after I was born, my mother, how you say, died. Kaput. Adios, sayonara, see you later, alligator. Her death was classified as an accident, which seems odd considering the knife cut both of her wrists. She was dead for 4 hours before a neighbor found her. She didn't leave a letter. At least that's what they told me, and there's no proof to say otherwise. And really, who am I to question these things anyway?
I'm Kurt Benrud, and this is The Turn by Tara Isabella Burton. Miles is an empath. Gets it from his father, says his mother. Always all about him. I tell her she can trust me. My references are excellent. I speak French. I know the vineyard. I spent 2 years looking after little Stuart Farnsworth, who could shatter China with his mind, and in all that time, the press never once caught on. It's gotten worse since the separation. I tell her I know how to fix him. Miles is 10. He plays Hayden. He wears bow ties. Sometimes he tries to claw his own face off. He rocks back and forth in the middle of the room, with his little arms around his littler knees, and shouts obscenities at the floor. I sit in the corner and think happy thoughts, and sometimes they distract him. I think of sheep, or dancing elephants, or what would happen if the 10-foot clock face at F.A.O. Schwartz came to life, and when he starts to giggle, I know that it's working. I tell his mother to go out shopping. Too many thoughts will clutter up his head. She's visibly relieved. Whatever's best for Miles. She's already out the door. She does not come home until 10. Miles and I teach each other games while we wait. I ask him to guess what I'm feeling. Now you're happy, Nanny. You're hungry. You want ice cream, he chirps through the gaps in his teeth. You want to play hide-and-seek. He knows I know he'll find me. When his father comes home on alternate weekends, I stand right outside the nursery door and think of all the beautiful things I have seen that day on my way to work. I think about the squirrels tumbling over each other in Central Park, about the red and gold tulips that burst out of the sidewalk on Park Avenue, about the dancing elephants in the window at F.A.O. Schwartz. I don't think about the commute, the blisters on my feet, the men who grope me on the subway, or the rent I can't afford. I think in clouds of pink and blue, and sometimes I think it works. One day, I cannot fix him. His mother has returned early from her shopping. Her father has arrived 3 hours late and lingered. They meet one another on the stair. I do not hear their voices, but I hear his. He sobs and screams and strikes me with a blow that would break my jaw if his fists were any bigger than Clementine's. I have to hold him down. I have to think in pink and blue. I have to pretend I don't hate them. At first I think he does not notice. When I hobble in with my blistering feet, when the cash in the envelope is $40 short and his mother has left early for her shopping and left Miles, shivering in pea-stained pajamas, to pick up on the mewing of the cat and start scratching the moldings for mice, when his father hasn't bothered to show up at all, I smile and think as hard as I can about dancing elephants. I think about how beautiful his mother is, and how fine is the shade of her lipstick, and how his father must be a very determined man indeed to have the success he has had. Not to notice an envelope that's $40 short. I invent ways to love them. It's only when his mother raps on the door frame with those dinosaur nails of hers and scoops him up in her arms. It is only when he spits in her face that I know what I have done. We play our game again. You're feeling weird, Nanny. You think you should feel bad, but you don't feel bad. You feel good, Nanny. You feel really good. I tell him what a boy he is. I tell myself it won't happen again, and that I'll think pinker, bluer thoughts. It happens again. First it happens in the living room, when his mother's tapping her nails and waiting for the caterer to call. Miles crawls into her lap and bites her breast so badly that she bleeds. Then it happens in the nursery, on a visiting Sunday, when he smashes a porcelain figurine of little Bo Peep and stabs his father in the thigh with the shard. Then it happens in the elevator, when Miles pulls his mother's hair so violently that she falls against the lever and catches her earring on the bellman's buttons on the way down. She takes me for drinks at the Pierre. I don't understand why he still insists on acting this way. Dr. Hankin says I'm making real progress. It's his father, you know. Such negativity. 2 weeks before Christmas, Miles's father shows up with flowers. Christmas Eve, he moves back in. You're angry, Nanny, Miles nestles in my breast. You're angry and your feet hurt. I tell him he'll be grown up soon. Grown-ups know thoughts don't just come in pink and blue. They tell me not to go home just yet. They tell me to stay just in case. They ask me to wait in the nursery while they open presents downstairs until I'm needed. His mother hands me an envelope. I just want his memories to be a family, you understand? Downstairs, Miles unwraps his presents one by one. Upstairs, I do not think any thoughts at all. I only close my eyes. I only feel. I only hate them. This time, I hear everything. I wait for Miles to come upstairs, his little footy pajamas wet with blood and urine, trailing ribbons, nuzzling his clementine fist in mine. Now you feel good, Nanny, he'll say. You don't feel bad, not even a little bit. I will offer him ice cream and then take him in my arms.
Hello, everyone. This is Seema Kukreja. Today I'm reading a sci-fi story called The Noon and the Mouse by Kat Rambo. The mouse sang to the moon. He sang, "Great wheels of cheese in the sky, eaten by the mysterious and restored each month to hover again. Grant me a favor. Grant me a bride." The moon peered down at him, for while it had heard many petitions from all manner of creature, and while many people had on occasion asked it, the moon, to marry them, no one had ever before that said, "Grant me a bride." The moon said, "How would I give you a bride?" The mouse replied, "Give me one of the youngest women that pledge themselves to you, who hunt with silver arrows and are chaste and seemly in their speech." The moon smiled a little and said, not ungently, "I think perhaps you are misnotioned here. Those wild girls are not for you." "Well," said the mouse, "then make me a bride out of a tender white cheese of your backside, a cheese bride who speaks little but is round-fleshed and plump as a dumpling." "Oh," said the moon, "that would not end well at all." "Then I'll leave it to you, for you are so much wiser than I am," the mouse said, letting his gaze fall to the ground before peering up hopefully through his lashes. The moon felt, like most people being flattered, the urge not to disappoint the mouse, and so it thought a while on the subject as it whirled about the earth, and for 3 days people remarked on the blankness of its face, until finally it smiled to itself. The moon is the queen of mirrors, for she borrows her own light from her brother the sun. And so she took a little mirror and enchanted it, and when she set it before the mouse, he saw nothing but an image of a smaller mouse, with pale white fur, who resembled him in every other aspect but her sex. He stared, wide-eyed, whiskers trembling with deep emotion, at his bride, who returned the gaze just as intently. "She cannot speak," the moon said, "but she'll always listen to you." So the mouse took the bride the moon had granted him and lived with her for a year and a day before he returned to the moon dissatisfied. The moon peered down at him again and took a while to remember him, for she sees many creatures every night, and many speak to her. "What do you want?" she said. "My bride is not satisfactory," said the mouse. "Not satisfactory are words for a thing," said the moon. "Is your wife a thing?" The mouse paused, sensing danger lurking underneath the words. Every wise being knows that few things are more mercurial than the moon's mood. So he picked his words as carefully as though stealing crumbs of cheese from a trap. "I talk to my wife, but she says nothing back." "I warned you of that in the beginning," the moon said. "You wanted a bride with bridled words, and I gave you the closest mouthed thing I could." The mouse looked sidelong at her, tilting his head so the moonlight fell on his long eyelashes and liquid eyes. After all, it had worked before, but the moon remained unswayed. "Few people can say that the moon has granted them anything, and you alone a bride? You should be content in your uniqueness." Disgruntled, the mouse returned home, but he found there nothing, as the moon had known he would, for when his reflection had vanished from the home, so had his bride, though she, like him, had gone out the front door. This is why the mice say, "Don't ask the moon for anything." This is why the moon says, "Don't grant the wishes of mice, for they always come to naught." But then, what the mouse wandering bride would say, no one knows. Thank you.
I'm Janice Peary, and I'm going to read Motivational Story by Eric James Stone. You start reading a story and realize it seems to be in second person, present tense, like one of those choose-your-own-adventure stories. But it's not. This story is actually in epistolary format, a message from me to you. I've chosen this method of communication with you because it's unobtrusive, and you can always dismiss it as being just a story. Well, who am I? I'm an author, obviously. The more important question is, who are you? And the answer is, you are the protagonist of my current work in progress. A novel about, well, that would involve some spoilers. By now, you're having a hard time suspending disbelief. You think it's highly unlikely that you are living in a novel being written by somebody. You want proof. I don't blame you. I'd feel the same in your position. And if I'm really your author, then I would know your backstory. I would know things about you that you've never let anyone else know. And I could put one of those things in the next paragraph, addressing you specifically by name, and then you would know for certain that I am your author. But I'm not going to do that for two reasons. First, you're not the only person reading this story, and it would be rather embarrassing for you in your world if the other people reading this found out about certain things in your life. But more importantly, if you knew for certain that you were the protagonist in someone's novel, that would really change the way you acted. For example, you would know that you could not die, at least not until your life story had reached some sort of dramatic climax, and I don't want you engaging in unreasonably risky behavior that would lead you into situations I would then have to write you out of. So, why send you this message at all? Well, you're not quite the character I anticipated when I started writing you. Now, don't get me wrong. You're a fine person with many admirable qualities. You also have flaws that humanize you, and that's all good. I'm not criticizing you as a person. I'm criticizing you as the protagonist of my novel. And you have to admit, your life so far is not quite bestseller material. Now, you may think it's wrong of me to criticize you as a character for not living a bestseller life. That's a plotting issue, you might say. If my life isn't novel-worthy, it's because you haven't given my life a novel-worthy plot. Fair enough. I'll confess to not being an outliner. I'm more of a seat-of-my-pants typewriter, so I don't exactly know where this novel is going. And I'll probably end up discarding the first couple chapters, which I've written basically to get a feel for you as a character. Now that I do know what kind of person you are, I've run into a problem. In the very near future, you'll face a decision where one choice would take you so far out of your comfort zone that it seems a little unrealistic that you would take that route. But that's the choice you need to make in order to go on the adventure of your lifetime, or possibly several adventures if my agent can get the publisher to agree to a multi-book deal. And that's why you're reading this story, so I can include a line about how you recently read a brilliant story. Okay, I'm laying it on a bit thick there. That had made you think about how sometimes you need to make choices that take you out of your comfort zone. It's your motivation for doing something that might otherwise be slightly out of character. Now that you've read this, I'm hoping you'll make the decision to choose your own adventure. Thanks, and good luck. You're going to need it.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.